Hey, what's up, everyone? Welcome to Reality TV Wrap-Ups for Episode 10 of Season 5 of The Amazing Race Canada. And we're going to break down everything from the alpacas to the algomas. Here to break it all down with me is Mr. Dan Heaton. Hello, Dan. How are you doing this evening?
I am doing great. I have some new enemies, and they are a very young group of kids. But beyond that, everyone is my friend.
You would have gotten away with an accurate giver count if it hadn't been for those meddling kids, Dan.
You know, why do they have to bring kids into this? What's the deal? This is an important thing. You know, I'm likely not going to win the draft, though I do have a team, which is better than US 29, but maybe I could win this. Throw me something here, Amazing Race Canada.
Actually, Dan, if you really look at the giver count, and we have not admittedly been keeping super accurate numbers, but I think you are actually tracking to be just about spot on. I think it just felt like they said it 153 times this week. And it turns out that's not actually true, because as soon as they started doing that, I did start counting. And I think I counted 23 total givers this episode, 17 of which came from the children.
Yeah, no, what I'm nervous about is if they win, like how many times will they lead the entire cast in a giver chant? John seems totally on board with this. He's like Mr. Giver. You know, he loves these guys. I think they remind him of him as a kid or as a 20-year-old or something. We need to stop this, Jess. We must stop. I want to win.
Why am I going to be stopping this? What's in it for me, dude?
Well, maybe you can win like a Chevy Colorado out of it or something.
I live in New York. This is not useful to me.
It's so fresh, though. That's what I've heard.
Yeah, I heard it's a sweet ride.
Well, no, enough about me, Jess. What about the episode? What did you think about this episode?
Well, I think we got to give our MVP award, and I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but I think our top story this evening is clearly MVP award to Georgie the Alpaca. Like, that dude, he participated in John's demo, and he helped Team Giver, and he was pretty much in everybody's task. Everybody that did the alpacas, they got to contend with Georgie, and Georgie did not steer them wrong.
Yeah, mostly, though. I don't know if what about Chili Willy or Rue? You know, how are they involved in this? I don't know. Did they get a prize for also participating?
They don't get a participation trophy, Dan. They're not millennials. Rue was a terrible alpaca in the task, I guess. It could be. Maybe it was just one of these needle in a haystack things where you had to just choose the one alpaca in the group that was actually trained in the course, because it sure seemed to me that they went through a few of them until they are like, oh, well, Georgie is the best one.
That's possible. Yeah. And we really, at least this season, we haven't seen that many animal tasks. I know the US version has had seasons where every week it's like, and now they must deal with the sheep, and then they deal with a bird, or, you know, there was a lot. We're here. This is actually kind of rare for this season. And I don't think these teams were totally ready.
Yeah, nobody's going to accuse this season of having the animal memory task at the end.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. I mean, I assume that next week's giant map that we see is not a map of all the animals they found, because it would be a very small, it would just be a giant puzzle with an alpaca on it, which, while entertaining, would probably not be the most difficult things for the teams to do.
Yeah, it's definitely, you'd have an alpaca and a bee, basically.
Yeah. Oh, it's weird that I forgot about last week's queen bee. That shows how thrilling that task was. But, you know, I shouldn't not mention this, but we did lose Karen and Bert, finally. We had picked them to go out fifth. They did go out fourth, but it was a valiant effort. I feel like they finished strong. They did not quit, and it wasn't easy for them.
No, this was a really hard elimination to watch. I mean, not in the sense that it was shocking at all, because I think you and I kind of agree that Karen and Bert have been circling the drain for most of the season, but this was really a hard way to go out. I think to have to lose a face-off, which knocks you really far down in the rankings, and then to show up to a roadblock, think that you're off the hook, and then it turns out that the person that's not doing the roadblock has to be confronted with their worst fear. That was really, really uncomfortable to watch, and I really felt so bad for Bert throughout this whole thing.
Yeah, this wasn't a case, because you have those cases where teams are freaking out about something, and I'm going, really, buddy? This was not one of those cases. One, it's a big fear for him, which is tough in itself, but two, he was at a disadvantage because I don't have the most hair of anyone in the world. I'm not Bert, but I'm thinking about it like, you know, when you've got a head of hair, at least there's something between you and these bugs. And I know I'm jumping ahead, but I think it's the big story of the week. But that looked painful. It wasn't just that he was freaked out, like, because he had to be near one. That was no joke for him.
Even people that don't have a problem with bugs are not going to be calling this a cakewalk. But to be a person that has active panic attacks in the presence of bugs and then to have them crawling all over your head for a solid hour, every time he kind of shook his head to get them off of him, it was really, really tough to watch. It kind of turned my stomach a little bit. And I have to give him props for getting all the way through that without even discussing taking a penalty with any degree of seriousness.
Right. Now I'm looking back at Bert's bio, and let's look under fear/phobia. Here it is. Bugs crawling all over me in a confined space or having to pick up a large insect. Now, it's possible he listed multiple fears and the show put that in there for this. But regardless, that's something to be at the final four and to be have a shot possibly. I know they were the last team, but they were, you know, Team Giver was not rolling through this either. And then to have to face that. That's something. It's the timing is really unfortunate.
It is. And some people with bigger tinfoil hats than ours might even say that when they got somebody on their cast who said that they had this specific fear, they made sure that they had that task in there. But you know me, I don't really go in for that kind of thing. But I think it was a nice bonus when they saw that he mentioned that. And I think you have a point. It would have been very poetic if that's the only thing he mentioned and it turned out to be exactly the task he had to do. But it's bad enough if that's one of the things he lists and they just kind of edited it because they knew they were heading that direction.
So what do you think about this? I mean, is this I do like the idea of involving the partner, but this was a little odd. I mean, I like it in theory, but in practice, how did it play out as possibly the most important task of the race so far?
Well, Dan, I've loved it historically when they have the roadblock that's kind of the fake out roadblock. Like, I think, for instance, the opener to Amazing Race 23, when teams had to look for their partner who was paragliding toward them. That
right,
was a pretty great fake out. And I think there was one, might even have been as early as season one, where the teams had to choose between a really tiny slow car and then being driven to the pit stop in a Maserati. And the person doing the roadblock actually had to be in the stupid small car, and the person not doing the roadblock got to drive in the nice car.
Yeah, that was season one. I remember because Frank was, you know, very big, large man in a very small car while everyone else was like, woo, this is awesome. So those are fun. And I don't have any particular problem. I mean, the thing is, it took Corey and Ivana possibly longer than Karen and Bert, if we believe the clocks. And I think Team Giver was right there, too. I don't remember the time. So this was no joke. If you're not Sam and Paul, who have, you know, the Midas touch in terms of tasks, I don't know if that metaphor totally works. But if they have that, if you don't have that special skill to somehow just solve a task, this was no joke to count, too. It wasn't just for the person in there. I was worried on last week's preview, it would be like a fear factor, stand there for 10 minutes. This was much more complicated. So I give him credit for that.
Yeah. And you know, if it had been the fear factor thing where you had to stand there and be timed, you and I would be complaining pretty hard about they didn't have to do anything. There was no skill. And so I do appreciate that there was some skill involved here. And it could not have been easy because I think even Sam and Paul were there for a while.
Yeah. And also it was tough. There's kind of tough on multiple levels for the partner. And you saw it too. We saw it with all of them, basically, where you're not only having to count, you're also in your head thinking, I am putting my partner through torture. And by not doing this, and really that was sad to watch with Karen too, but even with Ivana, where it's like really hard for them. How can they focus when they know that their partner is just like having these things crawl all over them?
Yeah, it was an extra added layer of difficulty because there's some compassion there. And you could see Karen, if one of those two was thinking about volunteering to take a penalty, it was definitely Karen who just didn't like seeing her partner have to go through that.
Yeah. And that's what really made me feel for them too, because, and you know, even after they finished and they're just like sobbing and hugging, and it's just like, I mean, oh, it's hard to watch, not hard to watch like, oh, I want to hide my face or something, but just like, man, for this, the show to bring that much emotion out of people, it shows the power of the race to go beyond just who wins. And it was a powerful moment. I felt bad for them, but it was also kind of a really memorable scene.
Do you remember a few seasons ago on Survivor? Actually, it was a lot of seasons ago now, where they would have the like Tylenol push through the pain moment. I feel like this was the push through the pain moment.
Yeah, I think I do. It was like they would show it like right during a commercial break, like after or before or something. Is that what you're thinking
of?
Yeah,
that's exactly what I'm thinking of. They would take a moment from the episode where somebody hurt themselves or something like that, and they'd say this person was really strong, they pushed through the pain, and sometimes it was a giant stretch. So, you know, maybe Canada can do like the Tylenol 3 push through the pain moment.
Yeah, though somehow it would have to be BMO involved, because, you know, the BMO wishes, though I don't know how you'd wish here, wish for no pain or something.
I would wish that bugs are not crawling on my partner's face.
Yeah, and I'm not particularly squeamish about bugs in general. You know, when I find a spider or something, a big deal, you know. But this, having some, and the way they dumped it on their heads, it's not like they were just standing like, you know, they've had them when they have to walk through and there's a bunch of mice or something. But just, and that weird box they were in, this was definitely a lot of Fear Factory things that I'm not sure I would have done well with either. You saw the people like Corey and Ryan, who were like not moving, like they were so still, like almost like they were trying to will themselves to not think about what was happening.
Yeah, I think that's maybe the way you have to do it. I think it's really a question of who can be the most zen in that situation and who can clear their mind and be totally empty. And not shockingly, Ryan did very well with that.
Yeah, the way he was like talking, even without moving his mouth, it was like, Kenneth, we need to finish. You can do it. It was like he didn't even want to move anything. And I also liked Corey's celebration while still basically inside the box. He kind of celebrated without moving, which I also found entertaining because he's like Mr. Crazy celebrating.
Yeah, that was some next level smizing going on with Corey there. But yeah, I think this was a very intense task, and I think kind of eclipsed almost the entire rest of the leg, which wasn't a terrible leg in general. I think we have to point to this as kind of the deciding factor that ends up eliminating Karen and Bert in the end. But really, Karen and Bert weren't having a great leg to begin with.
No, they had plenty of chances. So it's not a case where, you know, this wasn't like last week was not elimination and they started 3 hours behind. And I mean, everyone at least had a shot. And I know that's kind of how the face-off is designed when we get to that point. But it gives them a chance. And I did like, too, not having to start with some sort of kind of product placement task there. At least we started with kind of a cool 150 challenge. And it was pretty solid from there.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. Let's just go back up to the top of the leg. They're in Sault Ste. Marie this episode, which is a town they have not yet visited. And gosh, the scenery was fantastic. I can see why this was a Canada 150 challenge, because if that doesn't make you want to go to Canada, nothing's going to.
Yeah, riding that train, I mean, for them to look that good on TV, it's like I couldn't imagine being able to see the whole like vista or whole panorama, because they don't have to try too hard to make that look amazing.
No, they really didn't. And I mean, I'm a sucker for vintage train tours, so that already was pretty great. And this looked to me like it was a lot harder than it ended up actually being. Like, how many descriptions are you going to get where, like, all of these paintings, I don't know if you Googled Group of Seven after the episode, but all of the paintings are, here's a tree and a mountain. And how many descriptions can you read where it's like, here is a tree and a mountain? How do you really distinguish between them?
This continued the long trend this season of tasks sounding impossible and then being hard. And granted, teams did take a while. I mean, Sam and Paul barely got in under the 30 minutes and everyone else took longer. So it wasn't a case where it took no time at all. However, so it seemed like that once teams, this is different to me than say the Bears or something. Did it seem like teams, once they got certain ones, didn't have to answer those again? Because that's the way I saw it.
Yeah. And we've talked about this a lot before too, where if you have certain tasks where you have to match one thing to the other, like the beer task, for example, they wouldn't tell you how many you had right or which ones you had right. But it seemed like with this one, they were telling people that. And it wasn't super, super obvious, except that people weren't running back and forth frantically and not being aware of how many they had wrong. Like, they seemed to know specifically which ones were not correct. And I think with 14 or however many it was 14.
Yeah,
it was like 14. Two per painter, and it was the group of seven. With 14 paintings in the mix, you could have been there all day if you had to not be sure whether you had them right or not.
Yeah, and that's really true, because if you think about it, especially given how similar some of them were, that I can't even, teams would have ended up taking a penalty, because to try and come, I mean, maybe Sam and Paul would have got it probably in 22 minutes, but everyone else, I think, would have taken a while. So this, what they didn't, I don't think the show wanted us to feel like that was it. They weren't trying to be deceptive, but they, like you said, they didn't say they need two more, they need one more, but you really saw it, especially with Corey and Ivana, where they basically just had to flip the two and they didn't have to go back and read them all again, it seemed like.
No, it didn't. But they were very specific about what you had to call them. Like, I think there were a couple of instances where they didn't put the in front of it. Like, they were just saying that's white pine and it's supposed to be the white pine. So it was, you know, you had to be exact, but you had some knowledge of how far along you were in the process. And I want to point out a little bit of, I think, really good leg design here, because when I first saw this task and I heard that you had to be on the train for 30 minutes, and at the end of that 30 minutes, if you didn't have it correct, you had to be on that train for at least another 30 minutes. That made me think, well, this could really suck for one of the teams. Like, for everybody, you know, if Sam and Paul, for example, finish the first time and nobody else does, they have a 30-minute head start at least on everybody. But then you could end up with teams that are very, very far apart just by virtue of the fact that every time they try the task, it has to take them at least 30 minutes. A lot of these tasks only take you 30 minutes most of the time. So then to put a face off later in the leg ensured that you wouldn't have a huge spread and that there was still a chance to catch up. And that I really appreciated. I thought that was really, excellent, really elegant leg design. And where having either a face off or a task like this by itself with just the roadblock and detour and no other padding, that would have been a bad leg. I think these two things together made it a much more exciting and more interesting leg.
Right. And also the good thing about having the face off too is that basically teams get ahead, but they still have some advantage to get ahead. It's not like a case where pretty much they just bunch them together. Like, let's say they do this, then they go to a detour and roadblock, they get to a roadblock and it's like, you don't start until 7 a.m. the next day or something stupid. The face-off, while I know everyone has their own opinions about the face-off and we'll get to that, but it does at least, Sam and Paul at least have some advantage in that they're not just completely bunched together.
Yeah, exactly. They could have continued to be first. And I don't feel too terribly for Sam and Paul. I think they had a pretty good turn overall.
Yeah, they're not hurting right now for trips, for that matter, but also for skills, you know. But at least it gave the other teams a chance too. Because, you know, I say it kind of in the, well, at least it gives them an advantage. But obviously on the other side of it, which is probably more important, is that we don't immediately stamp. They may have finished first, but you don't automatically stamp them as the first place team like you would probably in most cases.
Yeah. And that's the flip side of it. It does keep it a little more competitive. I mean, without that face off, would it have even been close?
Right. And it's, what do you think? Mike Bloom asked this question. I think, you know, what, rather than delaying it, I'll just ask the question since we're bringing it up. But what do you think about the face off at the Final Four? Because this has been a standard thing. They've done it the last three seasons. And Mike pointed out, you know, that each team that has lost the face off and gotten the penalty has gone home. Now, obviously, there are other reasons why they went home, as we saw this week. But is this OK? What do you think?
I think it's totally fine. I mean, Mike does raise the point that with that few teams left in it, it does kind of, every little disadvantage you get makes it more and more likely that you're going to be going home. But I think with the task that happened after this, like to put a really, really intense roadblock right after a face-off really ensures that if you're on the top of your game, it's not going to kill you to be out last. Unfortunately, it was just the wrong kind of task for Karen and Bert. But I think any other kind of task that wasn't confronting Bert's deepest fear, they could have pulled out a win even. I don't think it's necessarily flawed. I like the face-off here a lot better than I would like, for example, a U-turn here.
Right, where the U-turn, even at the final five, felt a little bit too late almost for us. So I pretty much agree. I think, again, it goes to the leg design, though. Because if you put the face-off last, or even if you put it in front of, I don't know, something like even something that everyone could do, like ride a race car or skydive or something that doesn't give you a chance. But it wasn't like they weren't all in the same place. If like you said, and I'm going to repeat what you said, so it's kind of boring, but Team Giver, while had a chance of losing, it wasn't a guarantee that Giver, even though they were given it, giving it, I totally butchered that they were going to stay ahead of Karen and Bert. It happened that way. But I also think part of that was just the task worked out better for them. And overall, they're probably a better team.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, no disrespect intended to Karen and Bert, but I think had they been a slightly better team, they wouldn't have necessarily been condemned for failure in this leg. And I think particularly last week, they had a much better leg, but it felt like they had one really lucky moment that pushed them up to third place last week. And I think we were kind of expecting to see them go home. They certainly weren't my winner pick. I'll say that much. I'm glad they had a fun time. It was really great getting to know them and rooting for them, but they really felt outclassed, especially with the bunch of racers that we had this season.
Yeah. And I mean, if you think about it, though, really, it's like they got to the second face-off. So they had two shots to not be the last team. They lost to Sam and Paul, and they lost bad in both cases. They yep. lost 40-10 to Team Giver. So again, in this case, it may not happen all the time, but not only did they have a shot at the end, but Karen and Bert had two chances to change their fates, and they didn't do it. So the face-off really, it didn't give them an opportunity, but in one sense, it defeated them partially. But another sense, it also was fair because Team Giver had a chance to, they didn't just stumble to finish because they were behind and because of the alpaca.
Yeah, exactly. I think, again, this points to how well-designed the leg was. Like, anybody at any point could have improved or worsened their situation through their own skills. And I think that's a mark of a really good leg. And we have pointed to some really egregiously bad elements of leg design over the years. And I think this is what you should always be striving for when you're designing a race course.
Yeah, definitely. So I know I jumped over the detour, which I'll pack it or cast it, but have you done much fishing? Would you have been good at this task, or did it really matter?
It did not appear to necessarily matter whether or not you've ever been fishing in your life. I mean, some people that had fished seemed to find it easier, but it was really just a matter of having the finesse and having a good eye, I think. But I did appreciate, it seemed like this is something people actually do in the area, and it seemed very specific. I felt like there was much better sense of place than there necessarily was in the alpaca side of things. Sometimes I feel like Amazing Race Canada, for all of its showcasing of Canada's natural beauty and rich cultural heritage, sometimes I feel like they really have to stretch to fit some of these tasks into the Canada rubric.
Yeah, no, it was nice to see that. And I enjoyed the task, though. Yeah, it didn't seem particularly difficult. We did, of course, learn something interesting in the continued trend of kid pictures of people who've done things. Corey is quite a fisherman. Did you know this? Did you have this on your Corey bio that you expected?
I didn't expect it, but, you know, it did seem to help him. But it also seemed like everybody else who hadn't necessarily ever put on a pair of waders in their life were able to figure it out. But yeah, kudos to Corey. He seemed to kind of, he was in and out.
The Bassmaster caster, I've been told. Oh, wait, that was Yvonne. I think that's what he yelled.
Yes.
And then started flirting, apparently.
Well, he's good at fishing and at dope rhymes, I guess.
Man, they're fun. I don't know. I called early on that they just had that vibe like of possibly winning, but I don't want to jump ahead to that because we will talk about our predictions as we go, right? So the alpacas seemed pretty easy for Sam and Paul, of course, because that's the law.
Because Sam and Paul are gonna Sam and Paul.
Yeah, we're gonna have to start a new phrase, Sam and Paul it, which means basically take a hard task, at first go, oh, we're going to struggle, and then finish 2 seconds later. That seems to be the Sam and Paul to me.
I mean, who knows that? Maybe that was them struggling, and they just made it look really, really easy.
Yeah, because they don't even usually come close. It'll be like, you have 3 minutes, and Sam and Paul will be like, we did it in a minute 20. And I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was something where they had a lot of extra time. But thankfully, these tasks, while mostly easy, we're not for naught because Team Giver are not alpaca masters.
Well, I can imagine that being an animal and being around the kind of energy that Team Giver puts out, it might make me a little truculent.
Yeah, I wonder, you know, maybe that alpaca, you know, Rue just actually was Willie the one who couldn't get over the bar? Was it Rue? I'm trying
like
to remember.
Rue was the one that was really having trouble.
No, Rue was the one lying down. That's yeah, right.
That's right. Rue was lying down. Willie was kicking over the fence.
It's important we figure that. I'm glad they give the names, though. We talked about this with the horses, but I do kind of like the names with the animals in this type of case because it kind of adds personality that Willie was basically just like, you know, I'm going to lead them this far and make them think they have a chance. Then I'm just going to kick over the bar just to make these guys mad.
Yeah, it's always the question of like, which alpaca really is the smarter one? The one that does the course perfectly on the first try or the one that just subtly trolls everybody?
Yeah, and of course, it did lead to the rousing moment we referenced earlier where all the kids chanted the world's greatest word over and over while I hid under the couch.
And this was edited such that the children appeared to have picked up this mantle all on their own. There's a point where Kenneth looks over and he says, are they chanting Giver? And I'm thinking, yeah, like you didn't put them up to this, dude.
Yeah, that was the Amazing Race Canada. Not doesn't seem as manufactured as a lot of reality shows, but that moment, whether it was by Giver or it was by a really fun producer who in the background was going, say Giver. I'm inclined to believe Kenneth and Ryan were the culprits here, but you never know. Something was off there. Just like last week when the Orange Juice kids all of a sudden had a favored team in Sam and Paul. What's going on with these kids? Are they getting, do you think the kids are getting the early feeds before we are?
I think the kids are definitely getting some kind of coaching. But I have two theories on this. One is, as you said, I think maybe there's a producer standing off to the side and like coaching the kids and saying, well, these guys call themselves Team Giver. Let's cheer for them. Let's chant their name really loud. And the kids kind of take it and run with it because kids are kids. The other thing that may have happened, and we've talked about this theory before, and I think this week kind of lends credence to this theory, that there are an awful lot of givers that are winding up on the cutting room floor. And it's entirely possible that these kids heard these two having a conversation consisting of nothing but giver, 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 giver. And they were like, oh, I guess that's what we tell these guys. And since it is not an unfamiliar term up in the Great White North, the children just kind of ran with it on their own. That's my other crackpot theory. But regardless, there was something hinky about this, either in that we're not seeing all of the givers that Team Giver is throwing out, or that the children were coached to totally blow up Dan's giver count.
No, they're helping me. It's going to be perfect. Barring the chant at the mat or John somehow encouraging this. Stop it, John. I'm doing good here, like we mentioned, but in one sense, I enjoy the moment because it was so ridiculous and so goofy. I mean, it really didn't bother me that much. And that's kind of, it's the same thing how I feel about Team Giver in general. Most of the time, I find them to be kind of a fun team. They're not, but who knows? I mean, if we have any, I'd love to hear from an editor, though, what they're working with to present Team Giver the way they are. Because I think they're nice guys. It's not like they're not BJ and Tyler. Mm. You know, I will say, at least to me, they're not. Probably because they're Canadian and that, you know, it's still, they don't seem to be on that level. But there's something, I think the editors are doing us a favor.
I think they are too. But I also think that we are seeing, unlike necessarily your BJ and Tyler's of the world, I think what we're seeing is more or less what you would get if you were at, if you were at the bar with these guys. This is kind of what they'd be like. They might say Giver a few more times than we're seeing, but I think what we're getting is kind of a more organic team that's not necessarily constantly mugging for the cameras. They feel very natural to me, even if they are kind of irritating at times.
Yeah, and they're, it seems like they really want to win, and they're really getting a lot out of the race too, which that's kind of the most important thing. There are teams that are a little goofy and you think, you know, oh, this is a bit much sometimes, but I don't have any doubts that they're on the show. They want to win. They're competitive. And if that's the case, you know, and they're not boring. And actually, really, there aren't really any boring teams we've got going on right now, and especially looking at the final three. So with apologies to Sam and Paul, they're not boring either. They've brought plenty to the show. So I like this group. And of course, you know, I mean, who knew, speaking of the face-off and Sam and Paul, to jump into that, Sam comes from a long line of curlers. So another thing to add to something we know about him.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. In fact, the guy at the curling center even apparently knew Sam's grandfather. So that was kind of a crazy coincidence.
It's really too bad they weren't on season three. You know, they would have done even better than they did this week, where they were bested by Corey and Ivana's amazing skills.
And Dan, had you ever heard of croquet curl?
I can't say that I have. I mean, it reminds me a lot of obviously like bar shuffleboard or real shuffleboard or whatever you want to call it. But I like it. I thought it was kind of it's clever. The clever thing I liked about it is that they had to hit the ball, because normally in these types of things, you almost want to just kind of maneuver around and, you know, do different things. And if you hit one, great. But that seemed the extra thing, though. It didn't seem to be that hard to hit the other balls, though. That's what I thought was interesting.
Yeah, I would have thought, especially with those big spikes in the middle of the court, I would have thought it was much harder than it was. But maybe it's just that everybody on the show is much better at everything than I will ever aspire to be. Maybe I'm looking at these tasks and thinking, oh, this is really hard, and it would be really hard for me, but it's easy for them. Don't really know. But this was an exciting game that I think was easy enough. They were able to pick it up on the fly. It made for a very good face-off, and I think it wasn't necessarily the most exciting television to watch, but the editors did a pretty good job of paring it down to the essentials.
Right, because they did make it look like they were all doing well. But they were throwing a lot of rounds, and I suspect there were a decent amount of people just missing. And the editors were like, no, we'll just make it seem fun. We'll show they lucked out a bit where they had, like, you know, Corey and Ivana at the very end pulled out a crazy roll at the end. So, and then Giver hitting the middle, which is pretty cool. So there was enough fun things where sometimes things just have to work out well. And it continues, unfortunately, for our ideas, the line of sports related face-offs, which I suspect will go on forever.
Well, there was some sport and there was some strategy. Like, I don't think you necessarily had to be in super fit condition to ace the croquet curl.
True. And I do find this more interesting than golf, which saved it. I think more interesting than golf or the volleyball, which I think were the two last season. And I can't remember what this season was. They bowled, which this was more interesting than the bowling. I still think the curling might be my favorite, and beyond the penalty mess of the one. But no one asked us this, but I think this was up there for me. It was the strategy did make it more entertaining.
Yeah, I mean, apart from the rousing game of beer pong or flip cup that you and I have discussed to pick the ideal face-off, do you have more ideas that we can throw at the Amazing Race Canada producers?
Well, I know, I think I may have talked with, I don't know if it was you or Mike, because Mike was on the one where we had the first face-off, which it was interesting that he brought it up in the question, but that they could just take a test like the Canadian citizenship, but that might be kind of boring to watch. I don't know, because most things I think of are all just like doing an Amazing Race Canada task and doing it next to each other, which kind of eliminates the point. They do want something where teams are actually competing directly. So that does narrow it down. I did think about eating, but again, that could get ugly really fast. Some sort of fast, like competitive eating might not be the best move.
I'm thinking specifically of that maybe the worst designed Amazing Race leg in history would be that double leg in Amazing Race season 11 with the sausage.
Oh, yes. That, was that the intersection? Was that involved with that? Oh, yeah. There's so many flaws there. So you've gotta find the right thing. And it's not easy because even the polo hockey / water polo in a kayak, or I forget the exact name, might not have been a bad idea if you didn't have all the teams that couldn't really swim and were afraid of water. So even that might have worked.
I like looking at what other countries do for this. And I think the best one that we still haven't seen in Canada, the Amazing Race Israel version had a face-off. Over there, they call them double battles, but they had one where they played strip poker.
Really?
Yeah.
That I'm just trying to picture. I mean, obviously there was a limit to that, but that's I don't know if they do that on the Amazing Race Canada, but that's an interesting thought. You know, how did it go? I don't know. Was there anything notable about it?
I'm not totally sure. I haven't seen it. It's kind of hard to track down, I guess. There are people that make me look like a casual that would easily be able to scoop these episodes up and share them with us. But, you know, I just read about it in a summary and it didn't seem like it was terribly remarkable. But then again, Amazing Race Israel has their editing is so different. Like every leg consists of about 5 episodes and every episode has a detour and a roadblock and a yield and a U-turn and a double battle. And they just pack a lot in and they kind of stay in one place for a couple of cycles. So I don't think it necessarily dictated the outcome of the leg.
Yeah, that might be too much to take because, you know, I think it's great how many tasks the Amazing Race Canada has, but there have been a few episodes where I'm like, whoa, 5 things, or, you know, especially when you're podcasting, where trying to do a podcast about that. Oh my, I would like fill a notebook in like one episode or something of notes. But yeah, I'd like to check out more. I know I mentioned this last season at the end where I was like, I'm going to watch all of this. And I didn't really do any of that, but I know, you know, a lot more of me about this, but especially some of the easier to find ones. Maybe I'll actually do this season. So, or this off season, so then I can reference them more.
Yeah. I think it might be an interesting exercise. Like maybe we need to get Mike back in here because Mike's seen a lot of these as well and kind of give people some viewing guides for what seasons would be really especially great ones to catch for those of you that are interested in this sort of thing. But anyway, I think the sweet spot is probably 4 things per leg. I think whatever those things are, you know, we want your detour and your roadblock, but then I think there need to be 2 additional things per leg. That's my sweet spot anyway.
Yeah, I think that's what this leg was basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, exactly. This leg we had, I haven't done the math, but that's generally, I think we had one that had 5 and maybe a couple that had 3, but Amazing Race Canada generally does 4 things. And when the US does 3, I'm like, whoa, hey guys, you know, so I think 4 is about the right number because it gives you a lot of room to work with. And this leg lined it up really well. So I think it was good. I feel a little bad for my team and Karen and Bert, but now I have to root for Team Giver, I guess. Though, honestly, for my team, I might do that. And I have no problem rooting for them, but I'm not sure that's the team that I'm pulling for to win. But kind of in that vein, are we ready to do questions here?
I think so. I'd like, before we get into questions, I think we want to take a minute to kind of talk about our thoughts about the finale. Specifically, who do we think is getting the winner's edit? I think because we had a lot of people who were very strident in their feedback where they said, how could you think that anybody but Corey and Ivana or anybody but Team Giver, anybody but Sam and Paul is going to win this thing? Because the winner's edit is so obvious to me. And I'm thinking, I could make a case for any of these teams. I don't think there's any one team that's being pointed to as the anointed winner, but I'm curious to see what you think about this, Dan.
You know, I go back and forth because like way back, I think, like I mentioned a little earlier, I said Corey and Ivana are going to win. This was like episode 3, but then I kind of thought, no way, that's crazy, you know, because then Sam and Paul emerged and Team Giver have been solid characters throughout the season. For me, yes, you could say any of them are going to win. I still think, like, I was thinking about this, and it could go any way. I think Sam and Paul are going to win. I feel like they're a strong team. They don't really have a lot of weaknesses. I may be wrong, but I don't feel like the edit has made us dislike them in any way. It's made us root for them, and they're really good. And when all three have good edits, I'm going to think it's going to be the team that's the best. Now, with that said, the Corey and Ivana underdog edit is a real thing. But we've had plenty of underdogs not win. So that's where I'm leaning towards Sam and Paul. But my percentage is like 60% Sam and Paul, 25 Corey and Ivana, 15 Team Giver or something. So it's hardly like last year, I said last season, Jillian Nemeth are third. Steph and Kristen are about 90% going to win. And Joel and Ashley, maybe. Joel and Ashley kind of had a similar Corey and Ivana edit, though they were better. But Steph and Kristen seemed more likely. It's not that way, but I think Sam and Paul are going to win. Am I crazy?
You're not crazy. That's about where I'm at with it, too. I mean, part of me is thinking, well, maybe that's sort of like they're definitely the top dogs going in. And of course, Oxman's Razor would say that, you know, the team that is the best and strongest is probably going to be the team that wins. But then again, we saw in season two, we saw the insanely shocking upset where we thought that Spooner and Mickelson were a lock. Like, who else was even out there? And then one slip up knocked them back to second place for the entire rest of the leg. So I could see that happening to Sam and Paul, but I think I'm with you on this. It doesn't seem very likely to me. And I'm also with you on the fact that I don't see Team Giver having the strongest winners at it here. I think it would make sense if they did win, like we could pull a story out of that. We've certainly seen plenty of them. They certainly did give her this entire race, but they're not the strongest racers in the bunch. And I feel like of the three, they probably have the least amount of story.
Yeah, and it's crazy to say that Team Giver, who've been, you know, I was about to say the same thing you just said a minute ago, but they've had plenty. They've been all over the screen. There is no team that hasn't. And again, I'm just repeating what you're saying, so I'm going to stop right now.
Agree on everything.
Well, the thing is, I'm not convinced because Corey and Ivana, I would love to see them win. I'd be totally thrilled. They're so likable. I love the way they approach the race. They have the fact that, and we haven't seen them keep going. I mean, I know they had the comment about the last leg is first, but I think the producers pretty much said, so do you think the last leg is the most, you know, something like that?
Yeah.
And Giver said the exact same thing the week before. So I don't put much stock in that, but I would love to see them win. And I'd be happy with Team Giver winning. But odds on, it's not just because they've won all these legs, five legs, Sam and Paul. Is it five? I think it's five. I just feel like they have never finished below fourth. And a team that's that solid and consistent, when they throw five, six tasks at them in the finals, Team Giver will have a task they stink at. And so will Corey and Ivana. Sam and Paul rarely do. And I think that's the difference.
Yeah, I think Corey and Ivana will get lost somewhere, or they'll get in the wrong cab or something like that. And Sam and Paul, like, they are not only good at just about everything they touch, they're also extremely lucky. And I just feel like that luck is going to follow them into the final leg. And, you know, I called it, Amazing Race Canada has to kind of step up its casting, I think, because if they win, I will have successfully called it three seasons in a row, like just on basically looking at website bios.
Well, I will say in our draft, pick number one was Sam and Paul by you. Pick number two was Team Giver by me. And Corey and Ivana were lower, but, you know, I think you picked them like sixth or something. But still, for us to right away kind of pinpoint two of the probably top team, really by placement, probably the two top teams of the season, wasn't that surprising for us, I guess, you know?
I think you watch enough seasons of The Amazing Race and it's hard to pull one over on you.
Yeah, I mean, we can always be wrong, like my season 29 picks, but that was a little different because they were individuals. But with teams, it's you kind of get a general gist, especially this season where it felt like there were three teams that were obviously at the bottom. But to give them credit, I do like how consistent across the board the cast was. There wasn't one good team. There was five or six good teams and a couple that just seemed a little bit better.
Yep. There were a couple of the, oh, yeah, we had to have these guys. And then you had the really good racers. It's been a competitive field. And Sam and Paul just happened to be, I think, the best racers in the bunch.
Yeah. So they're going to Quebec City, and it looks like a lot of tasks, though I do see a few of the, hey, this is really epic kind of tasks. So hopefully we'll have also some other ones in between besides that.
I'm sure there'll be some sort of logic puzzle, perhaps related to the three animals they've encountered so far on the race.
that would be good. Like, just put them in order.
Here's a horse, a bee, and an alpaca. Oh, wait, that's the order they were in. Okay.
Yeah. Pretty straightforward. No, I suspect it'll be something like a task that's pretty hard to even understand on TV. So we will see. It's going to be fun.
Yeah, it always is. Okay. So now I think we can get to questions.
Yes. And we got a lot of questions. A lot of the comments were about the giver count. So I just want to upfront thank all the various people, including Danielle O'Coin, Craig, Jessica Frey, Rochelle Machinsky, Mike Boyle. There were more of you. All of you jumped in with the comments on the giver count, and I appreciate all of them on Twitter. So thank you all very much for that. But now that I've gotten that out of the way, so
I'm so glad that people are invested in the giver count. It warms my heart.
It's even more, they're invested in it even more than the number of Twitter followers that the Beatnik bus had, which, you know, I think we were the only ones invested in that, I think. So let's see here. Here's an interesting question. We'll start with Mr. John Johnston. So there was a point where when Bert was really feeling it, and I don't begrudge him at all that, but basically Corey and Ivana get theirs right. Team Giver is still in there in the roadblock. And Bert says, hey guys, can you tell me the numbers? And Corey and Ivana are like, no, and just left. So should Corey and Ivana have given Bert and Karen the answers on the roadblock? I have my thoughts, but Jess, I think you probably agree, but what do you think?
I think they don't have anything to gain that way. Like, don't help another team at the final four is my philosophy on this, because like, even if that is the desired outcome, like even if they would rather race against Bert and Karen in the finals, you really don't have enough wiggle room there to make that kind of call. And you don't have a guarantee that, you know, what happens, you know, you're Corey and Ivana, you're not the greatest navigators. So what happens? You give Bert and Karen the answers. Bert and Karen pass the roadblock. They take off. They pass you. They finish ahead of you. And oh, surprise, 30 seconds after Bert and Karen finished, Team Giver also finished and they also passed you. And now you're out of the race because you gave Bert and Karen the answers. That's how I feel about it anyway.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's too cute. It's not a case where there's five other teams behind you or something. This is it. Why mess around? You know, just get to the pit stop. And really, Corey and Ivana, I think, regardless of all their struggles, think they can win. If you think you can win, who cares who you race against? You know, it's not like Team Giver has won 12 legs, you know, or more than two legs or one leg. I'm trying to think, they won the opener, but I'm trying to think if they won another one. I think they did, but I should do better research. But in general, I don't think it matters, because even if they give the answers and Karen and Bert finish third this week and Giver's out, and then Karen and Bert win the race, how dumb would they feel? So why mess around? I think it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's even debatable. Like, if you've ever seen the show, you have to know that there's going to be a complicated logic puzzle relying on your memory in the final leg. And who do you want to go up against there? Do you want to go up against the slightly more cerebral Karen and Bert, or do you want to go up against a guy that thought Celine Dion wrote the national anthem of Canada?
Yeah. And actually, the tasks that have been the toughest, well, for Ryan, at least, were some of the math task and the test and things like that. So, and like you said, they're going to deal with that. You just, Ryan better hope it's not a roadblock, and not because he seems to be a very good racer, but in general, that seems to be what he stumbles with. So yeah, why mess around? Let's, you know, they made it, they had a very high finish for them. So they're in the finals, which, given how close they've come to being eliminated, is kind of amazing.
Yeah, I mean, props to them. I thought it was the right move, although that was also very awkward to watch, was watching Corey and Ivana leave the task and watching Karen and Bert say, give us the answer. Come on, give us the answer, because you knew they were both really hurting at that moment. And it didn't come off well on TV. I think they were really at a breaking point there.
Yeah, this was not a Travis and Nicole situation here, you know, from you know, with Jason and Amy or anything. So this was a case where he's facing a real fear. I think he just like, get me out of here, you know, anything. And Karen felt so bad, like we mentioned. So so what other questions do we answer? I know that there's some good ones here.
Let me see. Oh, here's a good one. Karen Wenham says, it was such a heartbreaking moment when Karen and Bert hugged after the challenge. He kept saying he was sorry. Seemed a deceptively hard challenge. What other challenges have been similar to this level of stress for both teammates in other seasons? Was it fair for all teams? What would be your cockroach?
Oh, that's a really good one, because I'm not sure I can think. I mean, there's the ones that typically are like this or have to do with heights and teams not being able to go. They eventually usually go, but teams just not being able to do it. And there's a lot, obviously, where somebody's like, they should have done it, like someone can't swim very well or something. But in terms of, for the first part of it, a similar one, because even I think of like the way that Dijon and Leilani went out, where they couldn't do it, where she, you know, she couldn't do it. But they were so angry with each other that this would, that really wasn't the same, because this was something where one really felt for the other. So I'm trying to think of a good example. Do you have a good example on this?
I can think of, I'm thinking of Keisha and Jen having to do the swimming challenge is one that I'm thinking of, or that really was stressing both of them out, but Jen more so. And I'm thinking this isn't specifically related to a phobia, but I feel like we got a little bit of this with Brett and Holly and the lentils in season one.
Yeah, that's a good one. Cormac and his mom.
Yeah,
that was a good one. That wasn't a phobia, but that was one where, and they seemed like they were going to be a good, they were a strong team. Oh, I felt bad for them the way that went down though too.
Yeah, that was pretty rough. And of course, if we're talking about like one team member doggedly pursuing something futile, we have to talk about the hay bales.
Yes, and that's probably that might be the best example of anything, you know, because they just, there was nothing that you could do, and just never giving up like that, you know, no penalty taking, Amazing Race Canada contestants. But, and I'm sure there are other good examples from teams that are being eliminated that I could think of, but in general, you know, it's just, that's one of the reasons the roadblock is, I mean, the hardest roadblocks are designed for drama in that way. Like, you know, the show wants to have the, I mean, they, I don't know if they want to have what happened with Bert, but part of them might have wanted something like that because it was really dramatic.
I don't know. I think it kind of veered into uncomfortable territory a little bit. It was a tough thing to watch, and it was hard to see them go out that way. But anyway, Dan, do you have a task that you definitely would not want to see?
You know, it's not about fears really for me, because I mean, I'm afraid of things. I don't love heights. I don't love closed spaces, but I think I get through them. It's not like catastrophic. For me, it would be building something like IKEA, or when they had to build the motorcycle or something. I, especially if I was doing this with my wife, who's really good at building some stuff, that I, something that was like that, because I'm just not good at that. So it wouldn't be a case where I feel like I'd be freaked out. I would just be really bad at it. And it'd be one of those deceptive tasks where you have your people that just see things spatially and I don't. It's like even something like if you just said like this desk I'm on right now, hey, Dan, put that together. It would be hard. So I think that would be more for me. But what would be yours, Jess?
Well, I'm not sure if I have one specific one. Like you, there are things that I really wouldn't want to do. But, you know, nobody enjoys, like, apart from a very small subset of the population, nobody really enjoys going into free fall. Like, it's, I guess there's a whole cottage industry around it. But I think the thing that I would find the hardest, and I think the thing that would stress me out the most, and possibly the main reason that I would never go on The Amazing Race, is that I would have a very hard time with not necessarily knowing the specific criteria of anything I was doing. And I am a terrible overthinker. And what would happen is I'd get caught up in a task that was supposed to be easy and probably should be easy to everybody else. Other people would be finishing it, and I might get one small thing wrong. I would not be able to see what it was. And I would possibly even have the task done completely correctly and have myself absolutely convinced that I was not correct yet, and that there was some other like entire level of complexity that I wasn't grasping. And I would get up in my head about it, and I'd end up taking a penalty, and I would end up getting hate mail from all of the Amazing Race fans. So that would be the hardest thing for me, is really like not having a firm grasp on whether a task is, you know, whether I've completed a task or not, and whether I've gotten it absolutely right. I would always be convinced that I wasn't totally there yet. And I think I think that would be the hardest thing for me.
Yeah, that's interesting. It'd be like that task where it wasn't the most thrilling task where they had to like match the decor on that little cart or something.
Yep.
And it was something so small. Like, yeah, I'm not saying you would do this, but
I would do
there'd
this.
Be like a pink little thing that you were missing and you'd be like, I did everything wrong. I'm starting over. Or like when they have to design find what's wrong and you can't find the one little thing or something and then end up starting over or the beer or whatever, you know. That would also be a challenge for me. So I understand. So that's interesting. So, all right, here's another good question, which I enjoy. Kate Ann says first, this is on Facebook. I'm from Sault Ste. Marie. It was cool seeing my hometown. And she did say, I feel like they missed out doing a task with float planes, which are very invented in Sault Ste. Marie, which I did not know. But here's the part I really thought was interesting. So if the Amazing Race went to your hometown, what task would they do that would be like unique to that town?
Well, are we talking my hometown or where I live now? Because I feel like they've been where I live now quite a bit. And in fact, I've designed whole New York-based Amazing Race courses.
Let's see your original, your hometown. Let's do that.
And I guess there's not a task that involves like spending entire years of your life in a flat place with nothing to do and not going crazy.
No, I think that might be too much of a long game for a show that likes to do like 3-hour legs. I don't know how that would work. There'd be a lot of hyperlapse cameras or something just showing you sitting there waiting.
There's also a lot of cattle ranching where I grew up. I think the much more interesting thing would be some sort of eating challenge, perhaps around one of Montana's greatest delicacies, the Rocky Mountain oyster.
Oh, yes, that would be good.
That's my final answer.
All right. So for me, I am in St. Louis, which is where I grew up. So it's pretty easy. I don't have to.
And the Amazing Race has been to St. Louis?
No, never been to St. Louis. No, they've been to Chicago. I think it's the closest they've ever been, but never. I don't think they've ever been to Missouri. Not even the family season went to St. Louis. No,
wow. But
So there's a lot of different things they could do. You know, obviously you could do the eating. You got the toasted ravioli. You've got, you know, lots of pasta, things on that level. Really weird pizza with Provol cheese that is worth trying. But my thing is people in St. Louis are nuts about Lewis and Clark. Because, of course, the Lewis and Clark expedition kind of began around this area. And there's monuments. There's a lot of monuments, a lot of statues, all of that. So being, for some reason, let's assume the Amazing Race Canada, since this is our podcast, came here. The greatest thing was somehow making them either interact with some Lewis and Clark impersonators and somehow get on a canoe or maybe recite a speech or some sort of dorky Amazing Race Canada Lewis and Clark task. That's where I think we're heading, because those are some of my favorites. How can you go wrong with something involving either memorizing or putting on costumes and getting in a boat or something like making them ride in a boat that was like what they rode and somehow navigate? There's so many good options. But for me, the Lewis and Clark, because, yeah, I'd love to say they could bungee jump from the arch. But I don't think that would happen. I'm not sure that would be allowed.
No, probably not. But yeah, it's funny. I think we've had this conversation before, Dan, where Lewis and Clark set out from your hometown and then kind of about 3/4 of the way through their trek, they wound up where I grew up. So I have a lot of odd Lewis and Clark trivia at my disposal as well. It's one of the things that connects us. And I love this idea. They could have some people dressed up as them and have to trace their route or, you know, listen to a story and repeat it. We like those. Amazing Race Canada is very fond of listening to a story and then repeating it. So that could happen.
Yes. You know, as judged by the Thor Odin one we had earlier with that wasn't repeating, but something similar, or the great speech we got in season 4. So,
yeah. Or the myth that they had to repeat of the wrapping the baby fish snug in the jacket. And that was season 1. But
gosh, that seems so long ago, back to season 1. So I think we've addressed most of these other questions. I mean, there have a few questions about why couldn't Bert wear a hat. My assumption is he doesn't have a hat, but that would have helped, I think, because Corey used that to great effect.
Yeah. Did Corey forget his hat? It looked like he dropped it on the ground and ran. So I'm not sure if maybe Corey just had a lot more hair than everybody else and so was allowed to wear a hat. And maybe the hat was provided for him. I don't really know. But yeah, it was interesting. It seemed like that helped him quite a bit.
Yeah, it I mean, it could have. I don't know if it would have been provided. I would have assumed they would have offered it to Bert, but maybe the show just didn't realize what that was going to be like. But yeah, I guess if you have a lot of hair, you have the opposite danger of somehow them just hanging out, getting caught in your hair and never leaving.
It could also be that that was Corey's hat. And after he had bugs all over, he didn't want it anymore.
He's like, that's it. There are no more with this hat. It served its purpose. I'm glad I packed it.
So, yeah, I think we're pretty much at the end of our program, and I'm very excited for the finale. I think it's going to be a good time. As I said, we really could see a win out of any of these teams, which is not historically true. We don't even really have to reach too hard to craft a narrative for all of them. So it's a very unpredictable game going into this last leg. It really could be anybody's game, and I'm excited about that. So we will be here next week to break that all down for you. I want to thank everybody that sent in questions. We really got a truly heroic number of questions this week, and we were happy to hear from all of you. And there are a couple of ways you can get in touch with us. I think the easiest and most instant gratificationiest of them all is to just tweet at us, and you can tweet at me at Haymaker Hattie,
and I am at the Dan Heaton, and you guys are doing awesome. Keep it up.
Yeah, we love it. And don't worry, I mean, obviously Dan and I are a couple of filthy Southern Yankees who can't watch Amazing Race Canada live because we don't fly up to Toronto every week. We catch it other ways at other times later on, but don't worry about spoiling us. I mean, really, even going into the last leg, we know what we signed up for. Feel free to tweet your questions to us as they occur. You don't have to wait for us to like drop a flag or anything like that. You know, while you're watching the show, if you think of something, tweet the question at us. We'd rather get it early than not at all. So that's one of the easiest ways to do it. The other ways to get in touch with us, you can leave a comment on robswebsite.com. Find the thread for the episode. Leave your comments there. That's better for things that are maybe a little bit, thoughts that are a little more complex than a single tweet could cover. And another way to talk with us, we have a robust discussion going on every week in the threads on our podcast patrons Facebook group. And to become a patron of Rob Has a Podcast, you just go to robhaswebsite.com/Patreon, and supporting the podcast helps continue to bring you excellent programming such as this very show. And we are always grateful to our patrons and to everybody that helps out around Rob's website. So with all of that, we want to wish you all a great week, and thank you all for tuning in. We'll see you next week.